Now time to follow the political money. I'm David Brancaccio in New York. Here is the money picture with the midterm elections 3 weeks out. Campaigns had to report their fundraising and spending for July, August, and September to the Federal Election Commission by yesterday. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer joins me now from Washington. Looking at this new data, Nancy, who raised the most?
So far this election cycle, Democrats running for Congress have raked in more than $1 billion. Republicans have collected around three quarters of that, and this is according to the Center for Responsive Politics. But this is only money the candidates themselves have raised. It does not include funding from outside groups, including so-called dark money.
And how about President Trump? How did his fundraising go last quarter?
Well, he did very well, and he's been out fundraising earlier than other presidents have been. The president raised more than $18 million over the summer, meaning he's already got more than $100 million stockpiled for his reelection. The president's campaign says 98% of the money he collected over the summer came from small donations of $200 or less.
So big donors are out of the game?
No. Billionaire Sheldon Adelson and his wife Miriam gave Republicans $20 million in the third quarter to help them hold on to the majority in the House. And billionaire Michael Bloomberg said last week that he's giving $20 million to Democrats trying to take over the Senate.
Nancy Marshall-Genzer in Washington, thank you. More CEOs have pulled out of a business conference planned for Saudi Arabia, given questions about the Saudi kingdom's role in the disappearance and suspected murder of a Saudi critic and journalist. Now it's the CEOs of Credit Suisse and HSBC joining, among others, the bosses of JPMorgan Chase, Blackstone, and BlackRock in pulling out. The U.S. Treasury Secretary was supposed to go, but President Trump now says sending a U.S. delegation is uncertain. James in Bridgewater, New Jersey, wrote to express his appreciation for the way that Marketplace presents business and economic news at the everyman and everywoman level and offers insights not provided by other news outlets. Now, if you agree with James, please join him as a Marketplace investor by donating online at marketplace.org. Thanks to James and everyone who makes our work possible.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
If a big international crisis hit, financial or otherwise, would the U.S. be able to coordinate help from our allies, this given the Trump administration's approach to trade and other world affairs? The other night, Leslie Stahl of CBS 60 Minutes asked President Trump about using tariffs on allies.
Well, I mean, what's an ally? We have wonderful relationships with a lot of people, but nobody treats us much worse than the European Union. The European Union was formed in order to take advantage of us on trade, and that's what they've done.
Well, Obama-era Treasury Secretary Jack Lew just co-wrote a piece in Foreign Affairs about using America's economic power. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you today, David.
Now, in the title of the piece, you assert that Washington is now abusing its financial might. I mean, what are we doing, burning bridges?
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, using your economic power as an effective tool is extremely important, and it's a ability to project influence that needs to be protected. What the piece argues is that we have to be careful and not treat the use of economic power as if it's limitless. And that if we act too much unilaterally, if we violate rules that we helped to design, if we don't build international support for our actions, there can be a backlash. Even if it works in the short term, it can reduce U.S. influence over time.
You write about what you call secondary sanctions. If I can explain it, that's a bit when the U.S. not only bars its own citizens or our companies from doing business with, say, Iran, but these secondary ones kick in, barring Americans from doing business with anyone else that does business with the target nation. And you think that's particularly thorny when you drill down to that new level?
What I'm arguing, what we're arguing in the piece, is that it's something that has to be used carefully, because if you do it when you're in the case of withdrawing from the Iran deal, breaking a commitment the United States made, in spite of the fact that by all evidence, Iran complied with the nuclear deal, that raises many questions. One, will the rest of the world cooperate with you? And two, will the country you're sanctioning change its behavior because of the sanctions? Which is not to say that Iran doesn't do a lot of terrible things. It was a nuclear deal, and the secondary sanctions that are going to be reimposed in a few days are being done notwithstanding the fact that all of the other signatories to the agreement oppose that action.
But if you hearken back to an earlier era when perhaps the notion of statecraft and respecting these international relationships was more front and center, there were still problems with the international trading community. We ended up with what many on the left and many on the right argue is a broken trading system with China. Maybe the playing according to the rules and making more nice wasn't working for people.
We may well have problems with China. I spent a lot of time as secretary taking these issues directly to the Chinese. But the way to deal with that is by making the point that you need to have structural changes in China, and you need to do it with the moral leadership of having been both the creator of the rules and complying with the rules of international engagement. I think that the current tariff policy is not an effective way to do it. It's hurting U.S. businesses, it's hurting U.S. jobs, and it's making for the world the impression that the United States is disregarding the rules that we helped to write.
Jacob Liu was U.S. Treasury Secretary from 2013 to 2017. He's now a visiting professor of international and public affairs at Columbia University and a partner at Lindsay Goldberg. He co-wrote the piece in Foreign Affairs, The Use and Misuse of Economic Statecraft. Secretary Liu, thank you.
Good to be with you, David.
A longer director's cut of that conversation about testy or soured global relationships will be at marketplace.org later today. Our producers are Michael Lipkin, Katie Long, and Daniel Shin. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.